Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Lockdown Toronto. And this is our 10th episode, so it's a bit of a milestone, and I really appreciate you coming along the ride with us. Today, my topic that I want to explore is the court system and the prison system and the detention system and how it's been affected by lockdown. And not only in Ontario, but across Canada, considering a lot of the courts and a lot of the prison systems are dealing with criminal law, which is a federal issue. And today I bring on a guest who's going to help us explore this issue. He's a criminal defense lawyer out in Kamloops, BC. He's with Jensen Law. He's written for The Sun, The Star, The Ottawa Citizen, The Huffington Post, and more, basically calling on the government to do something about the lockdown conditions that people awaiting trial, people awaiting relief from the courts, people in the prison system, and how they're affected by all this. His name is Joe Kaloran, and I welcome him today to Lockdown Toronto. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So how did you get into criminal defense law?
Well, I used to be a teacher, and I got a little bit tired of that. And my wife and I decided to try taking a leave and moving out to BC. And then I've always been interested in the law, so I decided to try going to law school. And then once I was in law school, criminal law seemed like the most interesting in terms of being able to explore constitutional issues, being people-centered, being interesting. You know, a lot of areas of law that might be more lucrative, tax or corporate commercial, are just, at least to my mind, intensely boring. Criminal law, I don't think even its critics would say, people who don't like it would say that it's boring. It's never boring. And it has a social justice component. It's political work. I see it as political work. I sort of naturally gravitated towards it.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I mean, you only need to look at all the shows on TV dealing with criminal law to know that. So you would have some unique insight into how the court system was functioning pre-pandemic. Was it well-funded? Was it adequately funded? Was there enough, resources available to the court system in order to deal with the overhead that it had?
I think there were enough resources available to the court system and to the jails, probably, but not nearly enough resources for legal aid or for defense. So not everybody was entitled to a lawyer. Not all legal aid lawyers were properly funded. And people without money or means couldn't access lawyers or legal representation. There's also, that's in criminal law, and outside of criminal law, access to justice is a huge problem right now. Hardly anybody can afford a lawyer when you think about how much they cost, $300 to $400 an hour. It's just prohibitively expensive. So the system itself, how it functioned, it was there and it was funded well enough, but it wasn't really serving the majority of Canada's interests.
Yeah.
And even pre-pandemic.
And so suddenly the pandemic hits, and Canada, in my opinion, kind of was slow to the game in terms of their response to it. But eventually, all the provinces started locking down. The Canadian government started issuing restrictions at the border about mid-March. And then April, you wrote an article basically imploring the prison system and the court system and the detention system to go easier, not easier, but understand the context in which they were closing down and holding people and putting them in the prison system, which could be a hot spot for spread. Could you explain that a little bit to us?
Yeah, with that article, I was mentioning that the bail system, I needed to function in a different way. So firstly, people arrested for minor offenses, I was imploring the Crown Counsel, which is the prosecutors in Canada, not to seek their detention, to let them go. Because, first of all, you're putting them in jail during a pandemic when the conditions are terrible. Often they're 23-hour lockdowns because they can't do anything in jail right now, prisoners. Mm-hmm. People may not realize that. Usually there's programming. They can go to the library. They can go to school. They can go to the gym. They can take religious instruction if they want.
Wait a second. It's almost right now, like solitary confinement, almost?
For a lot of places, yeah, it's 23-hour lockdown. And if you leave for a court appearance, you come back, and then you have to do a 14-day isolation period. So prison is extraordinarily harsh right now. And so I didn't think it was right that should be happening to people who were charged with minor offenses.
And minor offenses being what? Also thought, some examples of that.
So say somebody's charged with a breach, you know, they have a no alcohol condition because the offense they're arrested for involves alcohol and they've got a no alcohol condition. The Supreme Court just talked about this last week in a big decision called Zora that, you know, I don't think we should be charging those people anyways, but even without a pandemic, but in a pandemic, especially, it's an especially bad idea in my view, or other things, you know, they miss a curfew check. They don't report to their probation officer. These are the kind of breaches that people sometimes get arrested and jailed for. It's also more dangerous because those people go to jail for a very little time, sometimes long enough, you know, they're in and out, they're moving around from prison population to general population. They also tend to be people who lead high risk lives on the outside often. Some of them have drug problems. Some of them live in shelters. It's just seemed like a recipe for disaster to me.
Yeah, exactly. So did you see a slowdown in the intake to the prison population from, let's say, breach subjects?
Yes, I've seen the police have started not charging. I know they're waiting to charge a whole bunch of breaches, but they haven't charged as many. And they've done what's called, given what are called promises to appear, where they arrest somebody. So you could be just arrested on the street and just given like a piece of paper that says you promise to appear. That's the better way to handle minor offenses, in my view, in these circumstances, in many other circumstances too. So that has happened a little more, but there were still people being arrested for penny ante breaches and charged, and then, you know, sentences and or trying to deny bail for them. Bail is sort of a separate issue, whether somebody can get out on bail while they await trial.
So back to the people who are currently in prison, they're essentially being subjected to either a conditions that are that could be very hotspot ready, or B, solitary for 23 hours a day unless they're going to some program that they opt into. Has there been any evolution in the conditions there at all?
I think it's improving a little bit, but what you described is accurate, at least with the prison here. And even the programs, you mentioned programs, most of those have stopped. So, you know, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, those, the meetings or the counseling, violence prevention counseling, anything like that in jails, not going on. So I have people who are trying to get out. And one of the arguments they make, I make on their behalf, that I think it's a good one, is they say, well, how much longer should I stay in jail where I can't take any remediation, any rehabilitative steps right now? There's none of the rehabilitation programs are operating, or very few.
That's incredible. And I mean, the support programs also in the prison system, which are supposed to prevent recidivism on once they get out, all those have ceased too on the inside as well. Even on the outside, because outside everything is closed, including support programs. Ontario Superior Court Justice David Harris said in the press recently, leaving a man in jail would put him in one of the most dangerous places imaginable during the pandemic. And that was in response to 8 staff, 60 inmates test positive at a Brampton jail. And this was also in response to letting someone out. And that was a decision they made because they saw, I mean, prison systems everywhere are dealing with this. It's almost equal in the sense to other facilities that are experiencing hotspot pandemics of the pandemic, like the long-term care homes, where going in and out is just a non-thing, and the supports that typically take care of people on the inside are just very limited or non-existent. I find that incredible. So are people being let out during normal time, and when they are being let out or being let out early because of this, are there in Ontario, the supports are limited, but are there supports in BC that are still operating on some level to assist people in transitioning back into society?
There are some, but less than there were before. As you mentioned, you know, there's a lot of 12-step programs aren't running in person, but they're running Zoom programs. Shelters have bravely stayed open, and you know, my wife works as a social worker. They're still seeing people through Zoom and seeing some people, and the
frontline social services workers are trying to do what they can to help these vulnerable populations. But no, there's a lot that's shut down. And that was one thing that bothered me, is that anybody who's around lawyers for long enough or goes to law school will hear, it's just, you'll never hear more self-congratulation about the majesty of the law and the essential role it plays in society. And then just to hear all that for years and then to see the courts just shut down while, you know, baristas who make $12 an hour are working, and care aides who make $14 an hour are working in long-term care homes. You know, and you got judges making $300,000 an hour, and they don't want to deal with things. Even with it, and a courtroom, you've probably been in one. It's not a particular.
I've been in a few.
The judge is up high. He's not. Oh, yeah. You're not. It's very easy to social distance in a courtroom.
Yeah,
and yet
absolutely.
Still, the court shutting down was unacceptable to me.
So you alluded to some of the reasons for it. There's the stated reasons and obviously the operative reasons. And there might be a distinction there, which you highlight. And that is, I mean, there's stated reasons is that, you know, we have to protect our system. We have autonomy over our rules and procedures and all that kind of stuff. But you essentially, especially in the article you wrote recently, you allude to the fact that it's just a self-serving kind of thing where they were looking just to protect themselves, and essentially the consequence of that is justice denied or justice delayed. Well, justice delayed is justice denied. People basically waiting for things like child support decisions, people languishing in holds. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought the real reason was taken to protect themselves. I mean, there weren't sheriffs and guards still have to do the dangerous work of transporting prisoners and dealing with prisoners. So I didn't see how it helped them. I saw that it seemed to help judges and lawyers, Crowns and other lawyers who didn't want to appear and subject themselves to even a minute risk. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that's acceptable from an industry or profession that is so self-congratulatory and that is so well paid, especially while other people are in danger. The other thing was they said, you know, they sort of, what I think is they twisted around the idea of separation of powers. And I think everybody agrees it's a good idea for judges to be independent and you don't have a politician calling it judge and saying, I'd like you to find this guy guilty or to rule in so-and-so's favor.
Yeah, their official statement was, the decision to suspend regular court operations was made by the courts under the system of law. The judicial branch of government is separate, and as if we need the 101 of how the government works. The three branches of government, you know, Sir Johnny McDonald, like, to me, it was just an absurd kind of pass your buck, and also patronizing.
And the courts, all they do is serve the legislature, right? They're enforcing laws that people's elected representatives pass. They're a servant of the legislature. The legislature doesn't tell them what to do day to day, but the courts shouldn't just be allowed to say, we're shutting down. Yeah. You know, this is a constitutional democracy, to just say, we're not going to have court for 3 months. Nobody's going to have trials. Well, the right to trial is like an ancient 800-year-old right. And so for just provincial court judges or Supreme Court judges just to decide that's going to disappear is banana republic stuff, in my view.
Especially when they're still, you know, putting people in incarceration in circumstances in jail. I mean, and then suddenly the courts, the system of relief from that incarceration or validation of that incarceration, that's all gone. It's absurd to me. And were there, you bring up a good point, were there any efforts at the legislature? I mean, the legislatures were obviously sitting in a limited capacity as well, but were there any efforts in the legislature to highlight this issue or, you know, essentially tell the courts, like, hey, get your act together. You guys got to keep administering this section of law.
Not that I'm aware of, and it didn't seem that way. The former Attorney General of BC made a comment about how, I quoted that, how ridiculous it is that, you know, you could get a meal in a restaurant or a manicure in BC, but you couldn't, you know, file an application for child support, you know, from something that's supposed to be an essential service. So I think the pressure did start to build, but there was no official action taken. And one of the reasons I worry about this is this was, I mean, it's sad to say, and maybe I'm pessimistic, but there are going to be probably bigger challenges than COVID-19 in the future. There could be another pandemic. From what I read, it sounds like it's more than likely there will be. Mm-hmm. It could be more serious next time. Climate change is going to present huge obstacles for society to overcome. The fact that courts decided to shut down over this sets a terrible precedent for the future. Courts should be staying open. You know, they should be the last thing to shut down.
So that we can get it straight, they shut down unilaterally. It wasn't through.
They would say we didn't shut down because they continued to run telephone bail hearings and they continued to do sentencings, but they wouldn't do trials. They wouldn't do applications to vary bail.
Yeah.
So essentially their main functions and a lot of family court stuff stopped happening as well. So the bulk of their work they stopped doing, although they would pat themselves on the back and talk about, you know, how they stayed open, but they didn't really stay open.
But I guess just to clarify, there wasn't any emergency legislation enacted that told them they needed to shut down. So it was essentially the responsibility was all theirs and how they responded.
The chief justices of the courts, yeah, made the decision.
So it's more of what I call the too much, too late method of government response to the pandemic, where they just almost go overboard in their response, and they do it too late.
And then some of the responses were crazy, right? Like, so then corrections decides, so you can get somebody, you can be released on bail or even given a sentence where you're put on an ankle monitor.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably heard of that. People can get ankle monitors on them. Well, corrections started refusing to even put ankle monitors on people. So people who a judge decided were worthy of being released and deserved to be released with an ankle monitor, corrections just said, we're not doing that.
What?
Because of safety concerns. I don't know how much safety. I mean, wear a mask, you know, literally you clipped a little ankle monitor on and it's easily done safely, but there was all these kinds of things were common. Well, we can't do that. We're not doing that.
And there were no possibilities of people putting them on themselves in while being monitored by.
They just said they're not doing them. As far as I know, I talked to somebody yesterday who said they're still not doing them.
So talk to me about some of the cases and some of the categories of cases that are just kind of in limbo right now. You mentioned some of them. I mean, there were child support hearings. There were maybe bail hearing or not bail hearings, but parole hearings. Any kind of those types of things.
Applications to vary bail were in limbo. They're starting back up now, but that may sound minor, but that can be a big deal for somebody. So, you know, I had a client who she was sentenced to. What's called a conditional sentence order and serve in a treatment center. She was willing to go to the treatment center. It's religious treatment center. She's not religious, but she was willing to go. But then once the pandemic happened, all the treatment stopped. And because no more professionals were coming in and out. So all that was left was the religious component. So she doesn't want to be there anymore. But so normally what you do is file an application to vary bail.
Mm.
You can't do that. Right. So they weren't hearing those applications. She's just stuck somewhere where they're just praying, as she said, praying all day. And that wasn't treatment really for her addiction that was there. And she couldn't get an application to vary bail. So she left and then she got breached for leaving. Right. And that's another criminal charge she'll have to.
They threw her back in prison for doing that?
Well, I was able to keep her out. So they may still. I was able to kick it down the road a little bit.
Yeah, I guess if your main motivation for going for treatment, if your main motivation for going for treatment is the actual treatment, regardless of what it's kind of contained within, whether it be a religious or secular kind of system, and that's not there, then that's also a breach of conditions too on some level, is it not?
Well, it'd be breach of the conditions that that she was expecting to have.
Exactly. That's what I mean, right?
Yeah. It's not what she signed up for anymore. And, you know, so lots of those kind of applications, even applications like it was just very, I just had a very hard time. You'll get, say, an example would be somebody who's starting to have mental health problems, and they act out in a way, and at their family home. And then when they're arrested, they're given a condition not to talk to their family members. Mm-hmm. But then they're stabilized and they're in the hospital, and the family members want to see them again and say, you know, normally you'd file an application to vary bail, right? And say, this person's better now, they're medicated properly, and the family, that's the only support they really have. And well, those were for months, you couldn't get those through. So people were stuck in that kind of limbo, which is unfortunate. And it's always, as always, impacts the poorest, the most marginalized, and disproportionately racialized groups. And in interior BC, that's Indigenous people.
Yeah, I was going to say that, and I want to explore that a little bit more about how this is inadvertently, or not inadvertently, but systemically impacting those of lower socioeconomic status and marginalized communities. Before we go there, though, I want to explore the civil law system and how the civil courts are dealing with this. Is it the same story for people who want to, let's say, get a divorce or have a business dispute?
I don't know as much about that. I only know from going to lunch with my friends who do some civil law that everything flowed down, that it is hard to get applications for child support through. I think it's opening up back again as well. But as the Attorney General said, you know, there's essential services that aren't being provided. Some things are important, you know, and when family courts shut down, it's can be things like family protection orders, can be custody issues, it can be child support that's needed. Yeah. Those are things that weren't really functioning anymore.
Have you seen so the courts maybe have, not the courts, but the correction system has maybe limited the amount of people going into the system on some level, or and releasing people perhaps somewhat early. Maybe they're at the end of their sentence. Have you seen any reports or any statistics that show upticks in, let's say, crime or petty crime, even crimes of opportunity, that kind of thing?
Well, we've had I've heard anecdotal reports from the police. There's been some property crime increases, but I've also heard our chief medical officer, I don't know if that's her official name for BC's, Dr. Bonnie Henry. Mm-hmm. I know that in May, I believe either May or June, BC set the unfortunate record for most overdoses ever.
Oh no!
And I'd have to think that would, and that was already a high level. It's BC and Vancouver, so you know there's already a lot. And she linked it. She actually, it was quite sad. She cried at the press conference. She linked it obviously to people are alone. They're using alone. They don't have access to these services, and that also relates to drug users are criminalized in our country. They're treated as criminals for using a substance, and so that we arbitrarily decide is illegal while others are legal. Sometimes the penalty now for that can be death.
Yeah. So your chief medical officer essentially attributed one correlation to essentially social isolation. Have there been any other correlations highlighted?
He also mentioned to the lack of services, that there are fewer meetings for people to attend. There's less one-on-one counseling. It's harder for people to access services. You know, you can talk about Zoom meetings, but when you're talking about people who are struggling with drug use and street involved people, they're not doing a Zoom meeting. You know, they don't have a laptop or, you know, it's often the human connection that they need. And it, with those services aren't available then.
Right. You know, yeah. And I would imagine that especially even in the shelter system, that they're probably taking extraordinary precautions on limiting their interaction with the populations that frequent it there. So maybe their only form of social interaction with people are those in the shelter system. And even there, it feels very sterile and isolating.
Yes. Yeah.
It's incredibly sad.
Yeah. Very sad. And you know, and that's the brunt of this is being borne. I mean, there are people dying. I don't know how many, if it's as many as are dying from COVID, but there are certainly people dying because of COVID, but not from COVID.
Right.
That's happening on a daily basis.
I guess perhaps in the wider statistical analysis, they should, any kind of understanding of the effects of this on society should include those numbers as well, in order to
Absolutely.
Just get a better glimpse at, you know, the cost of trying to treat this thing rather than prevent it, as we should have done to begin with. But that was a topic for another show in terms of that. I'm still quite critical of the federal government's response to this. They should have had their act together, and they didn't. And if anyone's wondering what I'm talking about, go see the Taiwan episode. I think it's episode 2 or 3. And I'll link that in the show notes below, as well as all the articles that you penned and helped spur this discussion around. So, I mean, talks of a second wave of this. Perhaps the fall kicks around in some parts of BC. The fall tends to come sooner than later, and the winter tends to come sooner than later, which basically amps up the conditions for flu and flu-like viruses. Like COVID-19, and obviously a second wave will hit at some point. Uptick will hit at some point. People will become more lax with their care around this as summer rolls through, and they get into a different kind of habit stream. In the Spanish flu, the second wave was the most deadly. And has the prison and the correction system and the court system signaled any kind of way or put out a plan or a response plan in order to prepare for a second wave or an influx, or are they just dealing with things in a piecemeal manner?
It seems, I don't know of anything specifically that they've planned for a second wave, but they are doing things. So, it, you know, in court today, in my trial, there are plexiglass put up in front of the judge, in front of the witness boxes. Between every witness, there's a break taken and things are wiped down by cleaners. There's no more Bibles. If you want to swear in a Bible, you got to bring your own Bible or else you just affirm. We have to make extra copies and not touch them. There's gloves available for everybody. So they've taken all those reasonable steps, mm-hmm. which in my mind only begs the question, why couldn't we have done this in March right. 16th when we started having these problems? But I don't know that they have a specific strategy for a second wave, other than they're going to try to stay open and reopen and take these steps. And from what I can see, these steps are sensible and they seem to work. People are generally socially distant, and some people are free to wear masks. They're not spectators aren't allowed in the gallery at the moment, and you know, those all seem like prudent steps.
But obviously, so that's the court system. And yeah, just like any other public institution, whether it be, you know, you're going to see your local legislature, or you're walking even into a restaurant, you're going to have your dividers, you're going to have all your sanitation equipment and all the PPE for the people who are working there, limiting touching and spreading of stuff. But the prison system, people being locked down for 23 hours a day with no supports, or even limited supports inside, that there's something has to change there. There have been you've heard no bells ringing around that one, or
no. And I do. I represent prisoners as part of prisoners legal services. So they have something called warden's court, where if you get a prison charge, you're brought before a warden's court, and I represent people there. And no, I haven't heard of any. What's different about it now is that it's over the phone, those hearings, but I don't know any steps they're going to be able to take to bring things back to normal, other than I know some people who work in the prison. I have a friend who's a teacher in the prison, and he's sort of struggling to get back in. He wants to go back in. He wants to go see his guys and to drop off work for them and to touch base with them and to connect with them. Yeah. He runs a school where people can get their diplomas in the prison, and he's doing his best to keep it going. But no, I don't know that there's any. No, I think it'll continue to be hard time, and that's a point we make to judges now when we're trying to get a lower sentence for somebody. We say this time is hard time that they've been doing, and that should be taken into account. Some judges are more receptive to that than others.
So it's basically up to the individual judges to essentially lessen sentences. There's no legislative is there a way to...
There hasn't been any legislation, no. There's some judges who've made case law that says how it should be considered, but it's sort of a developing area. There's competing case law from... I like the Ontario case law at the moment better than the BC case law, but BC cases go further in BC.
Yeah.
to say that, you know, people should get out. It not only are they doing hard time, but they can do more on the outside to deal with their problems. At least on the outside, they can do Zoom meetings, or there might be some social distance stuff they can start to try to do. But as far as I know, in the jails, it's still a lot of lockdown. And even if they are let out, not in their cells, they're stuck on the same range
right, for
almost all day. Not much happening, and that's not good for guys in jail.
Yeah,
or women.
And the media has to do a better job. I mean, the two things sucking up all the oxygen in the room right now are obviously COVID-19, and also the protests happening around police brutality. Those are the two things endlessly soaking, and rightfully so, soaking up all the oxygen in the room. But the media has to do a much better job in highlighting these cases in the correction system, in the prison system. I mean, you know, lockdown on it's lockdown within lockdown. I mean,
yeah. And it's a good time to take the opportunity to say, I mean, I'm a prison abolitionist. So I always,
what is that exactly?
It means I think that society should be working towards the abolition of prisons.
Yeah,
I don't think it could happen tomorrow. I'm not proposing that we let every single person out tomorrow, but that should be the goal. And that if we look at prisons, I'd be hard pressed to imagine something we pay so much for and get such a poor result from. We spend enormous amounts of money to essentially make the problem worse. I think it was Winston Churchill, or maybe it's apocryphal. Anyway, somebody said it's an expensive way to make bad people worse.
Yeah,
Somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 a year to keep somebody in prison, and these are people we won't spend $20,000 a year on giving welfare or social assistance. You know, you could send them to Harvard for cheaper than prison, and they're people almost for the most part who have had very difficult, sometimes shockingly difficult lives from abuse and deprivation and. They suffer from mental health problems, and we essentially brutalize them, put them in cages, and then they reoffend.
Yeah.
So I don't even call it tough on crime, because if you wanted to be tough on crime, you wouldn't use prisons, because they're the way to make sure more crime happens. Look at the United States if you need any evidence of that. Somebody thinks they're tough on crime. Okay.
They have the largest per capita prison system in the world. Is that not right?
Yeah. And a murder rate, you know, roughly 10 times ours.
So the prison system is essentially an industrial model of trying to, quote unquote, deter people from crime. Does it work as a deterrent?
Not at all.
From your prison abolitionist point of view?
No. And that's one of the craziest things you hear judges say all the time. Judges, when they're giving a sentence, they have to say, they think all the time about the message they're sending with the sentence. You know, I'm giving him 120 days for the denunciation to send a message, as though anybody, particularly the prisoner, or are other people?
Oh yeah, no, come on. The prisoners are going to go on Canly before they commit their crime. Research, what is the case law on this crime I'm about to commit, and then essentially, prisoners in BC don't do that, or criminals in BC?
Yeah.
Come on.
Or I'm going to, you know what? I'm going to stab this guy. But wait, if I think I'm going to get 6 years for it, I'm not going to do it. But if I think I'm going to get three, I'm going to come on. Desperate, brutal, you know, crimes, but undertaken by people in very bad situations who aren't contemplating the consequences.
It's a very interesting subject, and I know we're being kind of flippant about the deterrence component of it, especially when it comes to judges' commentary. I mean, there is some deterrence element there, but it's not the whole picture. What would you say? If you had a magic wand and could foresee a future where there's a prisonless part of our corrections, what would that look like exactly?
So I think it would look like a Norwegian model, where they have more open prisons. There'd be a lot more education available. Each decision would be undertaken with restorative justice principles in mind. So what does the victim need right now?
Mm-hmm.
And victims often need things. Victims are often traumatized, and usually often the victims, what's happened in that particular crime is just the latest in a series of ways they've been victimized. So what does the victim need? Do they need counseling? Do they need job training? Do they need secure housing so they're not in a difficult or dangerous spot? What does the community need? And what does this offender need? What's more likely to make this offender, to rehabilitate this offender? And can those steps be taken? And if not, what's the least brutal way that they can be housed and contained? But I think that's a very small percentage. People focus on the Bernardos or the dangerous offenders.
Well, they do take up a lot of the ink in the media, right?
Yeah, and that's or even you mentioned TV shows. TV shows have, you know, criminals, and they wake up. They're people who wake up every day, and I'm a criminal, and what I do is I'm a burglar, and I'm a, that's not real.
It's as if they're super villains.
That's their profession. Like that, they, you know, they're people who steal because they have a substance use problem or they're desperate for money. They don't wake up that day, and you know that's their job that they would write on their income tax return, or that's the way they think of themselves.
Right.
Or I'm, you know, so there's very few criminals who are, you know, are actual organized criminals. Mm-hmm. It's mainly people who have mentally ill, very difficult substance abuse problems and come from a background of horrible trauma.
Yeah.
And they need help for the most part.
So can you explain a little bit more about what, obviously you spoke to the supports in terms of restorative justice, not just only supports for the victim, but also the person who committed the crime. And you spoke of a model, a European model. I forget which country you named there.
Norway.
Yeah, Norway.
Can you open prison.
The open prison. What is that exactly?
I think, from my understanding, it's more like a camp. I mean, you still have your restrictions. There's still restrictions on your liberty, but mm-hmm. there's a humane. You have more. I mean, people get mad when they say, you know, oh, well, I gave them a TV in their cell, or you know, I remember everybody was mad at. So when people can get their university degrees in jail periodically, where those kind of supports are available for people, where you can pursue your desire to flourish as a human being while you're in jail, whether that's spiritually, educationally, or learning a new career, staying in touch with people, where all those options are made as available as possible, where there's no punitive aspect.
Right.
Because the punitive aspect of prison is what fails.
Right.
It just makes people meaner.
It also, I mean, it makes them meaner, and then, you know, people can get organized in jail and in prison with other like-minded people. And suddenly they form a network that is very difficult to dislodge.
Yeah. And they also, if the only people you're talking to all day are other criminals, that you become entrenched in the criminal lifestyle.
Culture.
Yeah, it's a culture. You adopt it. There are clients I have who are, you know, they're so deeply immersed in that now, it would be very difficult for them to emerge. You know, think of however you identify yourself. I don't know where anybody does, you know, as mm-hmm. I don't know, whatever markers people have of their identity, whether it's nationality, ethnicity, or religion, or values, or as a leftist or a right winger, or you know, something like that. That can happen when you become acculturated in a jail too.
Yeah,
if you just sit around with people,
what they call being hardened, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's a good example. I mean, this is a bit of a history lesson, but I mean, in the origins of the Soviet Union, the black market emerged out of those who were thrown in the political prisons under Stalin's regime. And those who created the black market there eventually ended up becoming the basis for the oligarchs, who basically took over all the industry once the Soviet Union collapsed, because they were outside the system. They had developed these networks inside the prison system, even though they just began as political prisoners. And it's interesting that they didn't go into that system as prisoners or as criminals, but they came out of it in the mindset of, like, you know what, we're going to screw everyone over.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good example.
Yeah. And it's a long-winded kind of example, just kind of going back in history. So we got a little bit off track, but I found it a very interesting discussion, and I would love to explore more of that, and perhaps we can go back and forth a little bit, and you can send me some links I can put in the show notes. But I want to also explore opportunities for reform here. How are there, is there anyone carrying a political torch, not only around, I mean, I asked this question in terms of the pandemic and how the court system should be adjusting if there's any efforts in the legislature, but in terms of criminal justice reform in general, is there anyone we should be paying attention to at the political level who's kind of ringing the bells on this?
Any person? Nobody I'm aware of. I mean, there's organizations. I work with the Elizabeth Fry Society, the John Howard Society. I don't know so many individuals. I think,
can you explain a little bit about what they do? I know a little bit about the John Howard Society and how they create the support system outside the prisons and transitional supports.
And Elizabeth Fry is similar for women who've been criminalized, giving support to prisoners for transition. Second stage housing sometimes for people who are emerging, longer term support, offer counseling, offer help with linking people to legal aid. In terms of what would be good reform, the Supreme Court sent a good message last week, essentially saying, in layman's terms, what they said is stop charging so many bail breaches. Stop. Yeah, yeah. I think somebody who's not involved in the legal system would be surprised if they came into a courtroom and saw how much of it is breaches of bail. And then, you do one thing, you do something wrong, and then you get like six breaches, right? And then you're just wrapped into it forever. And then you get probation on that, and then you breach that. And I had a teacher once who was a judge and had been a police officer and had been a lawyer. And he had great experience with criminal justice. And he said, he couldn't believe the system of breaches. He said, when I was a cop in the 70s, there was one condition for bail: keep the peace of being good behavior. And if you did that, you didn't get bothered. There wasn't this entire probation industry checking on you. Are you, are you drinking? Have you had this drug? Have you remained in contact? Have you met your curfew? Basically, if you went and screwed around, yeah, then you got breached. But other than that, you were pretty much left alone. So the criminal justice system wasn't clogged up with all these minor breaches.
So some people have described the criminal justice system as an adversarial system. Is that a symptom or a result of a consequence of the adversarial system, where you have these overzealous prosecutors essentially asking for, the ninth planet in types of convictions? Or is it just a system that feeds on itself? Is it?
That's a good question. I think it's a system that feeds on itself. In some ways, I think I might even say it's not adversarial enough, and that everybody's too cozy and everybody gets along. Uh-huh. And there's far too many people who, one of the reasons I don't think you hear enough alarm bells ringing in the justice system or criticism's usually muted, is because a lot of the people, particularly the successful ones, they want to be judges or one day, or they want to get what's known as a QC after their name, Queen's Counsel. They don't have it in Ontario anymore.
What is
they
that?
Have it in a lot of other provinces. It's an honorific you can have at the end of your name, Queen's Counsel, which means you've been designated by some political people as a particularly honored lawyer. In BC, only 7% of lawyers can have them. And
what?
So there's all these
7%. There's a quota.
There's a limit. There's a quota. Yeah. And so you'll have
to get this status stamp.
Yeah. Wow. To get this status stamp, QC. And, and some people are like, real dynamo, amazing lawyers. And that's,
is this like the Boy Scouts where they get like badges and stuff? Like,
yeah, they get little badges.
This is hilarious.
Other people are just, and other people are just incredible kiss asses, and that's how they get it. They carry water for a political party, or they take a position on their local bar association, and they carry,
You're correct. I'm actually just remembering this thing where I had to hire a lawyer for something, and they found out that I was working at on Parliament Hill at the time for a certain member of Parliament, and they. I can remember the moment they said they reduced their rate and all this kind of stuff, and they didn't say why they were suddenly paying attention to everything and every communication, and then suddenly, and then 3 months later, they were asking me to put in a good word. And I was like, are you kidding me? What do you think? I go into the House of Commons and I stand in the middle and say, hey, everyone, just so you know, this guy over here down in wherever, make sure he's up and coming. You know, the I don't know, the brazenness, I guess, is just incredible and the status seeking. And but I guess there are those types of lawyers who essentially, you know, it's all about elite circles and status, and it's that old kind of old Canada model, right?
Yeah, and even lawyers, there's problems at the law school too, and that you're trained very early on in law school to really revere judges or revere senior partners at firms or senior counsel, to revere the justice system. It's a business like any other. It has horrible failings. I don't think it has much to be proud of at all. But you're taught that the stewards of it are these, you know, grand old men of the bar, and you're invited to things where you get to chance to, you know, rub shoulders with senior partners and judges or retired judges or judges in residence. So that sort of lickspittle attitude is bred into lawyers, and that, mm-hmm. that respect for authority for authority's sake is common.
Especially when they come into it so young, right? I mean, they come right out of university and law school. They're told that this is how to behave. So not only are they learning law, but they're learning the comportment of law. And at the end of the day, they turn into heel suckers, right? So, I mean, the elitism.
I don't mean to say everybody. There's certainly lots.
For sure. Of
wonderful lawyers and people I admire.
I know we're being very hard on lawyers because it's so hard to be hard on lawyers, right? Sorry, guys. But politicians always get the heel end of the stick, I guess. You're clearly cut from a different cloth. So, you know, how many of you are there out there?
There are a few, and there are people a lot better and a lot braver than me, you know, who really take on and make it their life's work and passion and battle and go all out, who deserve, you know. I'm just kind of a loudmouth, and I have, you know, I enjoy a lot of, I can do this. I'm lucky enough that I'm a white male. My wife has a good job, and you know, I had a career before this, so I'm lucky enough that I can do it without really sacrificing anything. But there are a lot of lawyers who really sacrifice and push limits and are quite activist and take risks. And they deserve a lot of praise for some of the issues they push forward. And when you hear about cool stuff happening in the law, it's usually them helped along by some non-lawyers who really pushed an issue, made it happen.
Yeah.
They're heroic. Some of them.
Perhaps you should start a 7% organization that highlights the great work of these lawyers, because at the end of the day, that old Upper Canada Society kind of, or family compact, whatever the equivalent is in BC, that type of attitude, I don't think it has place in a modern Canada. And especially since in a system that deals with so many marginalized people and groups, For that kind of mentality to kind of circle around inside that system, I think is very troubling. And have you seen examples of that manifest other than on a kind of general level?
Yeah, I have. So, you know, like I have it in general level all the time. One example that sticks in my mind is I had a client, a legal aid client. She's an Indigenous woman. And she was charged with something. She'd been arrested and she'd been released. And the Crown said, well, why don't she just pleads guilty and she'll get time served, so that the couple hours she had spent in the jail would count as her sentence. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on its face, a pretty good deal. And I said, well, I don't know. You know, I want to look at this. She may not want a criminal record. We might take it to trial, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, oh, come on. It's not like she's a world traveler or something. Meaning, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not like she's,
you know, because that's why you really wouldn't want a record, right? You don't want it on your passport.
Yeah, it's screen. Not like she is. Like, she has potential like to be not, a human being.
She's not gonna. And you get little remarks like that quite a bit, and it's helped along by the costumes. We wear ridiculous costumes and gowns and frippery.
I like that you call it costumes. It's like you guys and motorbikers are the last ones standing, who love wearing your costumes and. Public.
I don't love it. It's sweaty and you look like Phantom of the Opera talking to Santa up above you. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
You feel like such an ass. Like you're like, there's a bunch of adults in this room dressed like they're at some weird, you know, Eyes Wide Shut costume party or something. They're, you know, a head waiter at a restaurant. And they'll sometimes make the argument, oh, well, it's just so all the lawyers, it's not like the fancy lawyers. One lawyer can just wear a fancy suit and be better. Except that might hold a little water, except that you only wear your gowns in superior court. So it's not meant to level everybody out.
Right.
It's clearly meant to establish a hierarchy of who's allowed to wear gowns, who's wearing gowns, who's important, and to increase the distance between lawyers as practitioners and the general public, to make us more removed, more separate.
Yeah.
From real everyday people.
And I mean, it's supposed to be a court of law of the public, but I mean, anyone who's ever been in a courtroom for a case, you know, of any seriousness understands the gravity and the intimidation that goes on even just in that system, like just in that room. It feels so weighty, and like, I don't understand you just bringing a normal person in off the street.
You're already scared.
You're scared out of your mind, and you'll do whatever they say. So then you add in the element of people making remarks like that person did behind the back. Oh, it's not like she's a world traveler. It's like, how do you know? Are you just making a judgment on based on her race, her appearance, maybe her class, wherever she comes from, her location, and also the deal making behind the scenes is weird to me. It's either someone is guilty or they're not guilty. What are they doing when they're doing that? Are they trying to save the court time? Is that resources?
Yeah, because you could never run trials for everybody.
Yeah.
And often as a defense lawyer, it's often in your client's best interests to lower their jeopardy by taking a deal. Okay. But even there's all kinds of ways that class and money and you know, background and race factor in, right? Like if you've done something and you're middle class, let's say you know, you get really drunk and you stab a family member, you know, if you're middle class with resources, there's a whole bunch more I can do for you, than I could for, you know, a poor indigenous person on a reserve.
Yeah.
I could get you, your parents could get you into treatment. They could get you, your own, we would get you your own psychiatrist at your own cost. We would have one who we're pretty sure is going to say what needs to be said, right? We're going to be able to, we'll probably be able to get you out on bail because we can put up a cash surety, if not even our whole house that somebody doesn't have a house won't be able to do. We'll be able to provide sureties who don't have a criminal record, right? Because you may travel in those circles rather than somebody whose parents are residential school survivors and themselves have criminal records or something like that. So there's just at every step along the way, it helps to not be from a racialized or marginalized group and to have money. And then we'll also, you can pay for your lawyer. So that lawyer is going to be really, really motivated to get you the best result. They'll set it for trial. They might file charter motions on how to exclude evidence, that sort of stuff. Whereas if you only can afford legal aid, your legal aid lawyer is not going to be as well funded to do that sort of stuff, and right. might be more interested in just resolving it.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we get your stabbing knocked down to assault and get you a conditional discharge where the other person, it ends up stays as an aggravated assault and they get 3 years in jail.
Wow. Right? And that's so all and they're, based they're, on money.
And yeah, it can be in an extreme example. Yeah, it can be. Yeah.
And I guess as we all are aware of the policing issue and the discriminatory practices with policing that have been such a heavy subject in the news as of late, we should also be reminded of how this plays into the court and the correctional system as well. And Joe, I really appreciate you coming on the show and helping us walk through this and any other legal matters in the news, in politics, in related to lockdown in general. I would love to bring you on again if you would so come on.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It's been a great discussion. We've explored a lot. Is there any way people want to get in touch, can get in touch with you? Do you have an online presence of some sort, or is it just a matter of searching?
I guess my email address is our mutual friend Lex would make a lot of fun of me right now for having a Hotmail address, but he
Hotmail
never
Hotmail lawyer. Ah, yes.
Yeah. JRKM79@hotmail.com if somebody that's my personal email address if anybody wants to get in touch or hire a lawyer if they need
or
a lawyer
hire a lawyer sure Hotmail lawyer I can't believe you're yeah, a Hotmail exactly. lawyer that's
Hotmail
awesome
lawyer.
It was that's just a famous reference because I think it was Rob Ford's lawyer at one point he went through a bunch of them but one of his latest ones was was a guy who responded to media requests through a Hotmail account so they started dubbing him Hotmail lawyer.
Oh, well, yeah. I do have a professional account, but I just figured I'd give my personal one here. So
yeah, absolutely. And I'll link that in the show notes below and make sure that people can get in touch with you. And I'm going to link your articles as well. And people will be able to get in touch with you and at your more professional email account through that as well. And
sure.
Joe, I really, really appreciate you coming on. And I look forward to having you on again. In the future, and thanks for coming on to our 10th episode, which is a big milestone. So congratulations to us and the team and you for coming on. I really appreciate that. And for those tuned in, if you have any questions or concerns, again, you can email us info@pod6.com. That's info@pod6.com. If you have any questions, concerns, show ideas, guest ideas, anything. Also, make sure to search us out in your podcatcher in any form. We're on Spotify. We're on Apple Podcasts. We're everywhere you can get us. So you can listen to this podcast in audio, share with your friends, especially Joe's interesting stories and take on the court system. It's a super important podcast, and I want you to listen and share that as well. Until the next one, we'll see you again soon. Cheers.